We're all on a journey of life for a very short period of time. We don't know how long it'll be. But what we do know is that we can be everything we can be ourselves, but above all, try to make a difference in other people's lives who are also on this journey of life, which we'll usually know very little, but by coming to know them, we may know more.
Great companies are all about the people. Good people become great leaders, mentors for work and life.
Welcome to Learnings from Leaders, the P&G Alumni Podcast. I'm Andrew Tarvin, humor engineer.
And I'm Roman Segal, recovering marketer. Andrew and I both got our start at P&G, the Procter & Gamble company, where we both had the opportunity to work with some amazing people. And as you may know, many leaders across industries got their start at P&G. In this series, through conversations with fellow P&G alums, we hope to go deeper with the leaders you already know but want to know more about. How they got their start, how they make it work, and what keeps them going.
It's kind of like bringing a microphone to a cup of coffee, or in my case, hot chocolate.
On today's episode, we're going to hear from a lot of people.
You know, that just might be the understatement of the year, Roman.
Yeah, Drew, it's hard to believe we've been doing this P&G Alumni Podcast for almost a year.
And we've had a lot of great conversations with some pretty amazing leaders.
I think what you meant to say was that we've had some amazing learnings from leaders.
Yeah, you just got to shoehorn that title in there. Are you sure you're still a recovering marketer?
You know, just when I thought I was out, they pull me back in.
Not sure that's a movie you want to be quoting on this particular podcast.
So look, as the year winds down to a close, we thought we'd sit down and reflect on some of those learnings we've had from all of our conversations.
Wait, does that mean this is going to be one of those greatest hits episodes?
No, it's going to be a few greatest hits episodes.
Oh, that's great, because half of our listeners just got really excited. They're like, greatest hits, that means that we get the summary of all the fantastic lessons that have already come through this year, and the other half have just hit the unsubscribe button.
Oof, I hope not, because we've got some really amazing guests lined up for 2021.
I can't believe we've got Michelle Obama and Melinda Gates.
Now who's the evil marketer, Drew? That sounds like fake news.
It's worth a shot. Plus, you never know who we might be able to get.
Seriously, there is no way we could cram in all of the amazing learnings from all of the year's past guests into just one episode.
Right. After all, we've had a really diverse set of leaders.
Yeah, from some of the biggest names in P&G's history to some of the leaders from the biggest brands beyond P&G.
Yeah. And so who are we talking to today?
Well, for this episode, we decided to focus on some of the greats from P&G's histories. Some names you've heard of, like former CEOs Ed Arts, John Pepper, and Bob McDonald. And some of the leaders you definitely should learn more about, like Edward Goh, Kasser Sharif, Jorge Montoya, Linda Clement Holmes, and Shantanu Khosla. And of course, if you missed any of these and want to hear more, definitely check out our podcast feed and go find their episode if you haven't heard it already. But after all, this is just the icing on the cake.
Certainly. And these lessons that they share are incredibly valuable and insightful, whether you spent years at P&G or barely even know it as an acronym. I think it's really exciting what people are going to have in store. So who's up first?
Well, it's actually our first episode, John Pepper, P&G's former CEO and Disney's former chairman. You know, for many of us, John Pepper represents one of the greats, not just P&G CEOs, but business leaders and human beings. Honestly, one of the great privileges of just doing this podcast, I joke, I'm done doing this podcast because I got to talk to John Pepper. And the conversations I've been able to have with John on and off the air since our first episode have been some of the best conversations I've had this year. So let's take a listen to John Pepper.
Moving along in years, I think you will realize the most important thing you leave behind is not a legacy. Rather, it will be the influence you've had on other people by how they've observed you operate or work or act. And not only that, but how you've made them feel as a person, as an individual. I might just add one thing to that I've come to believe in a more concrete way than I would have if I were talking to you 10 years ago even. And that's the importance of what I call transformational relationships. There are all kinds of relationships in life. They're transactional relationships. We have them. We need them. They happen all the time with a bartender, with a dry cleaner. You have personal relationships. Those are very, very important with people you've come to know and depend on. Could be the teacher of one of your children. Certainly many people at work. Personal relationships, ones that have formed trust and you're counting on each other, vital. But there are a select other number of relationships. I call them transformational relationships. And these are relationships which really, they change your life. They change the way you think about yourself, and they change the way that you think about other people. And we all have them. We probably don't call them that. But I think of the transformational relationships in my life, obviously starting with my wife, that goes without saying, with our spouse. But I've had them at work. The relationship I had with John Smale was transformational for a lot of reasons, but above all because of what he modeled, but because of the trust he placed in me. That's what made it transformational. The relationship with Jack Claggett, way back when he was that two-up boss who invited me to have, that was transformational. To the day I die, I will never forget about him and his wife showing I mattered and cared. And we're all having transformational relationships with other people, or at least we can. I think it's terribly important we have transformational relationships, and it's harder with people who are different than we are. The opportunity, if we think about it, if we're more intentional, though you can't make them up, they have to come naturally in the end, based on mutual respect. They can change, and they will change people's lives. Ed Harness, who was a CEO in the toughest times, probably economically, and perhaps up to this one, in the company's history in the 70s, once walked by me in the corridor 15 years before I became CEO. You know what he said to me? He said, John, take care of yourself. Make sure you're getting enough vacations. We may all have to come to depend on you one day. I couldn't believe what he just said. Hell, I wasn't sure I was going to make it to the next level. Can you imagine him saying that? 15 years. We may have to depend on you one day. Take care of yourself. Make sure you get enough vacations. Holy smokes. Another time, he was in Italy during that tough time, and he came for his first business review in Europe. He'd just become CEO in 74. And I went through the business review and must have been uptight as all get out. And at the end of the review, we walked, just the two of us, back to the elevator on the third floor of a building in Aeor outside Rome. I'll never forget it. And you'd have to know Ed to appreciate this. He was a big man, former football player at Marietta College, one of the great humane men, women I've ever known. He put his arm on my shoulder and looked at me with a slight smile. And he said, John, he said, sometimes you just have to wait for the other shoe to fall. You're doing the right things. Believe me, everything will be all right.
Wow.
He must have recognized that I was tense under pressure. And in a moment of unplanned, total candor, generosity, he said something to me still early in my career that basically conveyed trust and confidence. It didn't change probably the intensity with which I went back to work, but it did change my view of the nature of leadership and the nature of this man who, a great human being. It's not only what you do, it's how you make other people feel.
Wow. To me, what makes John Pepper so great is not only the work that he did with the business at P&G, but also the impact that he had for pretty much any person who's ever gone through that organization since. You know, the stories and lessons from him come up over and over again, not only from our time at P&G, but from the guests that we have on the podcast.
Yeah. And beyond all of his professional experiences, again, even beyond P&G, like even companies like Disney, where he has stories to tell about Bob Iger and Steve Jobs, John embodies this idea of purpose, values, and principles. He's actually the guy who kind of crafted that language for so many of us who came through the company. And from talking to John, you get the sense that the human effect, how you make people feel, is just as powerful as the business results.
We're all on a journey of life for a very short period of time. We don't know how long it'll be. What we do know is that we can be everything we can be ourselves, but above all, try to make a difference in other people's lives who are also on this journey of life, which we'll usually know very little, but by coming to know them, we may know more.
Very poetic, I think, in a sense, right, around making a difference in other people's lives. But, you know, sometimes as a listener, you hear these things and think, does that kind of mean that you have to give a life of servitude? What does being in service of making a difference in other people's lives, how does that actually translate to the day-to-day work that you do?
Something John said that has really stuck with me, it's not just what you do, but it's how you make people feel. And I sometimes think that gets lost on us. We get so focused in the day-to-day work, getting our job done, getting the best results, and the human effect. When all is said and done, people aren't going to remember you for your business accomplishments. Maybe a few people, but the people that you worked with, the people you made an impact on, the things that you inspired them with, and the things that they learned from you by watching you and working with you, that's what matters most. And I think that's John's perspective. So many leaders that came up through him and with him and got to know him, some you've heard of, some you've not, the effect on how John made them feel is kind of what matters most.
Yeah, and I think that's a really great distillation from that is it's not just the what you do, but the how you do it. So it doesn't have to be that, oh, big into give everything away, but more of in that process day to day, whatever your work happens to be, and whether you're the leader of the organization or brand new as someone that's just recently joining, that how piece becomes really important. And it reminds me of another great conversation that we had with Linda Clement Holmes, who is P&G's former chief diversity officer and chief information officer, because you had a great conversation with her about how she executed her how with authenticity and courage, her experiences as a Black woman rising through the ranks of P&G in the IT function, and her philosophies and approach that allowed her to be such a great fit for the company's first chief diversity officer.
Yeah, her perspective on how to think about race and other people's experience is really powerful.
If there's a race, and there's a starting line, and we're all lined up together, and everybody on that line has the same experiences, the same capabilities, everything, and everything is equal. In that race, it's all the same, except on me, on the race, I'm wearing a backpack. And in my backpack, I carry being African-American in a country where that's been an unequal environment for a very long time. I carry my bag that I'm a woman. And, you know, particularly if everybody else in my race is male, I have that in my backpack, too. So I might have kids back there. I might have whatever in my backpack. So but I have to run my race and still be as fast or faster than everybody else in the line who doesn't carry the backpack, weighing them down. And that's kind of what it's like in a career, in a corporate setting, is that we're running this race and I have to be just as good as everybody else, but I got a backpack on and they don't. So one of the things that as chief diversity officer always tried to do was to listen and understand who's got a backpack and try to lighten the backpack whenever I could. Now, you can only do so much because it's not just me, one person. Everybody's got to do their part, right? Everybody has to do their part. And I was proud of the fact as a company that we were able to craft a strategy that was global in nature, but it was only one step, a baby step. And there's lots of other steps that had to be taken. But, you know, at the end of the day, the company is made up of 100,000 people, and you want 100,000 people to be 100% effective every day. Yeah. And that means don't put false backpacks on people or empty them out or whatever. And that's the path. That's the journey. And it's not a one-shot deal. It's a journey. But it's an everyday journey that every single person has to live.
So the timing of our chat with Linda was really appropriate, given some of the long overdue conversations our nation is finally starting to come to terms with on race. It's been a long year. And what I really appreciated was we didn't just have a theoretical chat about work, but also for how so many people, race affects our whole selves. We got into some deeply personal conversations about those bigger issues, how home life affects work life and vice versa. It's not just what we're experiencing in our society, but what we're experiencing in our everyday lives.
Yeah, and for me listening to it, it raises a question as a listener is for yourself, are you bringing your authentic whole self to work, or is there something keeping you from doing that? And so that's what I love about her focus of not separating out the two. And it's something that I've come to find in myself, and we've talked about it with many of our guests about this idea of quote unquote work-life balance and how that's really a bit of a misnomer, especially in today's world where it feels like work-life survival. But what is the actual integration between the two? And are you making choices about what's important for you? And what's important is going to change absolutely over time, something that Linda talks about.
I was very quiet, not necessarily shy, but quiet. So I didn't talk a lot. I talked when I had something to say, pretty much still do that to some degree. I probably talk a whole lot more now, but I was very quiet. And at the same time, in the field of technology, you have to think about, this was 37 years ago, there weren't that many women in the field, and there weren't that many people of color at all in the field. Mm-hmm. So Often I was the only woman, person of color, whatever. And if I go to a conference, that might be 500,000 people, and I might be one of one or two or whatever. So to have confidence in that setting is really, really tough. So my self-confidence wasn't very high at all when it came to my technical knowledge and so forth. So I always thought everybody else knows more than I do. And when I first started, I had to deal a lot with vendors who were doing a lot around innovation and things like this. This was back in my first sort of interactions with Silicon Valley and things like that.
Right, right.
I remember thinking, oh, how overwhelmed I was and how much more they knew. And I had a vendor say to me, make some comment to me about what I didn't know or whatever. And that really sort of took me aback. And I thought about it, and I think I talked to some people, and it dawned on me, wait a minute, I'm a customer. No, it's not okay. And it dawned on me at that point that it doesn't matter what you know or don't, or you think you know more than me. At the end of the day, it's my decision that matters. And it turned the tables. And then my confidence all of a sudden switched on where it hadn't been before. And that it was okay to ask questions, that it's okay that you don't know because it's not possible to know everything, that it's okay that there is somebody else in the room who knows more than you. That's actually a good thing, right? But it's okay to ask them questions, or it's okay to say, what are you talking about? I don't understand that. And that was a hard learning for me at first, because I felt like I'm supposed to know everything.
Something I love about what Linda just said was how you don't always want to be the smartest person in the room, just being humble with what you know and what you don't know.
Exactly. I think that's why we hang out, right? You don't want to be the smartest person in the room, so you got to make sure that I'm in that room with you.
That's not exactly what I meant, Drew, but I'll give it to you. It's really about that focus on surrounding yourself with folks that know things that you don't know, and being willing to admit that you don't know something and ask questions. And, you know, as I work with people at big companies and small, the trait I look for beyond character and purpose and values is curiosity, knowing that you don't know everything. It's about getting over your own ego and, again, bringing your full self and being open to learning new things and recognizing there are people who know things that you don't. And speaking of just really impressive people that are honestly a lot smarter than me, Drew, I loved hearing your conversation with Jorge Montoya, the former president of all of P&G Latin America and currently on the board of both The Gap and Kroger. It was a really good conversation about doing the right thing and developing leaders, especially in Latin America.
As you can imagine, Latin America is not an easy place for preaching that kind of a discipline. But we made sure that in order to sleep very peacefully at night, you had to make sure that, one, you recruited the right people. In other words, people who had absolutely no qualm with principles, and you can detect that very early on. Mm-hmm. And you just repeat and repeat and repeat, and once again, show by example. We always said in Latin America, of all places, you cannot give in even once for 1 minute, because the moment you set the precedent, you're lost. That's it. When I had just gotten all of Latin America to run, that was 1985, my first 4 months were a disaster. Because the general manager from Mexico called me, you know, this guy, it's a government account, by the way, mm-hmm. and they won't buy anything until we get him a car. And he was honestly just informing me, because he knew and I knew what the answer was. So Claude mm-hmm. Salomon said, no sales. I went to John. And once again, I was just essentially informing him of the sad news, but mm-hmm. there was not even for half a second the thought crossed our minds that we would yield to that kind of a thing. So what we have learned in Latin America is you find somebody who knows us very well, who somehow has access to those folks that are requesting these kinds of wild things, mm-hmm. and let them know that there is absolutely no way that P&G would ever yield to anything like that. And they doubt it. Sooner or later, they realize that that's the case, and they just come back. And that's what happened in Mexico. And of course, use that and other instances to show that there is absolutely no compromise whatsoever under any circumstance. You have to really do the right thing every day, every moment, on every occasion.
One of the things that Jorge really emphasized, particularly in that clip, is the importance of hiring the right people, but even more so connected to the right people is having a clear understanding of what it means to have good principles for your organization. And I think that's something that we sometimes lose sight of. And so as a leader or as someone who's looking to hire, whether that's a full-time or contractor, are you thinking about what those quote unquote good principles are? Is it about them doing what they say they're going to do? Is it about them following or having a certain code of ethics? Is it them, as Jorge mentions, their connections with being firmly in their principles, but making sure that that aligns with the culture and the principles of the organization is a key part to making sure that the person you hire is actually a good fit.
That's so true, Drew. And once you find good people, you don't want to lose them. It's all about making sure you enjoy what you do and the people around you enjoy what they do. So they don't want to stop working necessarily. It's funny, Jorge even started to talk about the idea of quote unquote retiring and what that means or doesn't mean to him.
In my mind, the one thing that I will never say is I will retire. The word retire, and by the way, it doesn't mean 8 hours per day work. Mm-hmm. It's just you have to be active somehow. Mm-hmm. It's never late to learn anything. Okay. So my thing will be I need to find other activities, whatever mm-hmm. they are. It doesn't have to be work. When somebody says it's too late to start learning something, I said that's pardon the French, but that's BS, because there is always time to do. All you got to do is just look at, you know, Einstein at age 60 or more started to learn ancient Greek, okay, mm-hmm. which is not easy. Moses led the Jews out of Egypt when he was 80. So there's always a chance to do something.
There's this idea in improv, which Jorge's conversation kind of reminded me of, and that is you do the hard work in an improv scene early on. You get the what, the why, the how, like the principles of good scene workout in the first, say, 30 seconds, because then once you do that quote-unquote hard work, you get to have fun for the remaining 4 minutes of the scene or however long that it's going. And that's what it reminded me of, what he was talking about, because once you've done this hard work of gaining this experience and insight and capability, there's almost this fun of getting to execute. And I think that's why you see him on a lot of different boards, is because he has this great wisdom that he can share. And rather than it just being out on a golf course somewhere, he wants it to be in the room or in philanthropic efforts. And so I don't know, what do you think, Roman? Are you someone who, do you share his views on retiring? Do you think it's a word that you won't necessarily do? Or are you like, nope, I'm happy to go and live on a beach somewhere?
I don't know how to relax, Drew. I mean, I'm supposed to be on a sabbatical and I have a few podcasts and I'm consulting with mission-driven orgs and I'm doing political action work. I don't know if I know how to stop, but it doesn't matter, because if the work is fun and the work is invigorating and the work honestly has purpose and meaning and value to other people's lives, it's not work. And it's about keeping your mind active.
I agree with that. And I heard from someone years ago this idea of, you know, as an entrepreneur for myself, not necessarily retiring from my business, but retiring in my business, of basically getting rid of all the things that I no longer like doing and outsource or delegate them or have someone else do them and just do the things that you really enjoy while still giving back. Because I'm the same way of, you know, I can get 30 minutes into a vacation and be like, okay, what are we going to actually get done? How do we actually execute this type of thing? But one of those things that I do actually enjoy in terms of taking a break is, and this is kind of cheeky to say, is listening to this podcast, because you get introduced to ideas and insights from people you wouldn't necessarily know of otherwise. And one of those people for me was Kasa Sharif, who was P&G's former head of Pakistan and Ukraine. And you know, as you can imagine, from a senior executive in Pakistan in the mid-2000s, he had some pretty incredible stories to share, including one that he titled his book after. But it was great to be able to hear those types of insights from someone that's maybe not as big of a known name.
We ended up acquiring a manufacturing facility just 25, 30 miles outside of Karachi in what is really a tribal area. And a couple of weeks went by and I was visited by a couple of tribesmen from the area. And they came and first under the guise of wanting to congratulate us, offering us all kinds of help. And then they wanted us to do some favors for them. And while they were sitting in a conference room in our office, I was told that they had come in a Jeep with a couple of gunmen waiting downstairs. I politely spoke with them for almost an hour. These tribesmen, when they came asking for favors, they were specifically, they had made up a story saying that we have some students who are really good from our tribe and we want to give them gold medals. And of course, I had politely declined to offer them money for gold medals. And in the end, we sent them home without giving them any favors, of course, which we were not going to do. It was really, really important that I treat these people with a lot of cultural sensitivity. I could have easily, you know, called in security and got these people thrown out of there. And the next day they could have lobbed a hand grenade into our factory and we couldn't do anything about that. We weren't going to do them any favors. I think that being from there and understanding the cultural sensitivities, the whole notion of saving face was really important in my ability to handle them. At the end of that 1 hour long meeting, when I sent these tribesmen packing, is really when it dawned on me in a very clear way that Procter & Gamble can be successful in Pakistan while adhering fully to P&G's principles and values. Because people had said to me that, listen, there will come a time when you just will have to bend a little bit. And a little bending a little bit, I mean, I also learned that there is no such thing as bending a little bit when it comes to basic principles and values. You either stick by them or you basically don't.
What you have to understand from that story, he's talking about tribesmen in Pakistan who were making demands with machine guns. It's just so interesting.
I particularly now interested in hearing about his perspectives, not just from the other side of the world, but from someone who's from there, like that actual real life kind of story. Because as someone who's been around the world a few times, traveled quite a bit, but I was born and raised and worked mostly in Ohio, and then for a brief period of time in New York. But now I'm in Panama in an international situation out of my comfort zone. And so I can really start to appreciate his take on that outside perspective.
Yeah, what drew me to Kasser was actually hearing about his book from John Pepper speaking on stage at a P&G alumni conference. And I remember as soon as the talk was done, walking outside, buying the book immediately and devouring it on my plane back to New York. The stories and reflections, honestly, they go so much deeper than just his international experience in Pakistan and in Ukraine, but also his personal realizations about his own motivations in his career, which as someone who's been rethinking a lot of the aspects of my career, I could totally relate to.
It was kind of challenging, but it was also a moment of truth for me. Am I really going to push for what I think I want to do? Or am I going to step back and say, hey, I have a nice, comfortable job, it pays well and so on. I mean, why rock the boat? So I rocked the boat and somehow came out okay at the other end. And since then, I continued to rock the boat, not in a bad sense, but continue to jump at interesting and intriguing opportunities that came my way.
Something he touches on is this idea of being comfortable with being uncomfortable. And to hear Kasser say that, someone who's an executive far more experienced than me, that makes me understand a little bit more that it's not a bad thing to lean into things that make you uncomfortable, because that's honestly where some of the biggest growth is going to come from.
And I would argue where most growth comes from. Like if you do only the things that you're comfortable doing, you're not going to grow. I was reminded of it with Kasser is that as we get older, for whatever reason, if we try something and we're not good at it right away, we're like, oh, I'm just not good at that. And you almost put it on the shelf. And it's almost like, well, if you never did things that you failed at initially, then we'd all be still crawling around on the floor, because when you first learned to walk, you fell a lot. And so it was just a helpful reminder of even something like that simple extended into a career perspective can have a big difference in terms of your own personal and professional growth. And someone who's did that pretty well in their own career was Ed Arts, who is P&G's former CEO and chairman from 1990 to 1995. And I had a chance to talk with him about his incredible experience during his entire career at P&G. He was the person that they would bring in to solve the hairy, audacious problems, the wicked problems. We had a great conversation about what he learned about being his leader during his entire duration at P&G.
We don't require geniuses, just very smart people of good character. P&G people are very smart people of good character. As we define it at P&G, is a combination of the moral values that are distinctive to each individual. When we interview people, we like to know why they have done the things they have done in their life to date. What have they done to help make their school, their community, the world a better place? Because that is, in fact, a part of P&G's culture and always has been, going back to the founding partners. And the character of P&G employees is what supports the company principle of always trying to do the right thing. And I have always believed that integrity can also be a competitive advantage for the company. Because people that we deal with outside the company, they know that we're not going to be compromising our principles for expedient gain. So our salespeople don't get constantly bothered for favors, nor will we succumb to requests for bribery in countries where we need a permit or a license in order to invest and operate freely. Another character trait of P&G people is that they care about the development of the people working for them. It's an important part of our culture. Being a good mentor at P&G is a valued asset, and it's almost always stressed in performance reviews. That's perhaps P&G's number one strength, its people.
One of my favorite quotes from this entire show is that integrity is a competitive advantage. It's kind of like what Jorge said as well. Ed just kind of captures this interesting idea that if you're known for doing the right thing, and the company is as well, everything else is just like so much easier.
You know, a lot of my experiences are through the comedic lens, but it's a similar thing in comedy, is that when, as a stand-up comedian, you get a very clear what they call a persona, it almost makes writing stand-up easier. Like, you almost know what to expect from Chappelle. You don't know what he's going to say, but you know kind of the direction that he is going to talk about. Or you know kind of how John Mulaney is going to be, or Tig Notaro, or Ali Wong. Like, right, once you develop this reputation, some of what Ed is talking about, it becomes almost a competitive advantage because it makes the process easier. It's not a barrier that you have to overcome, but it's just, oh, this is what we get with this company or with this person. And so you can bypass any argument or conversation about it.
One of those things you learn is that with experience, sometimes knowledge gets lost when people retire or leave. And, you know, it's really important about capturing and distilling that knowledge for the next generation. And that's something we also talked about with Ed.
Every P&G leader I have known has said in one way or another, those who fail to learn from their mistakes are destined to repeat them. However, the bigger the company became, the harder it became for our future leaders to know what those mistakes were. It was harder for them to learn about our successes as well. Now, I was fortunate to have been elected to the company's administrative committee while we were still in the old Wynn building and still meeting daily in the executive dining room. It was a remarkable experience for me. I was amazed at how much you could learn from just hanging around all these men, listening to them talk about the company. Imagine having lunch each day with R.R. Dupree, Neil McElroy, and Howard Morgan. Ed Harness was there too. And I learned a great deal from hearing those leaders, hearing them talk about their knowledge of our history and their wisdom as the company's decision maker. And then the company became too large, too busy, too geographically diverse. And those daily gatherings, the tradition died. So that's why we created P&G.College in order to restore that tradition in a way that reached virtually all of our future managers, not just the senior executives. Also, instead of casual discussion, we created case histories based on real events, case histories that provided significant lessons for the future. And we recruited our active company executives to serve as the training instructors. The culture of a tribe is passed on for generations by gathering around the campfire. And that's when the elders pass along their knowledge to the upcoming generation of future leaders. It's a time to tell stories. It's a time to share experience and transmit the wisdom behind the tribe's guiding principles. The campfire is essential to the group's longevity. I have benefited from those campfire-style lunches in the old executive dining room. Every company of any size needs to have this function in its own way in order to preserve company lore as well as its prospects for longevity.
This is such an important idea, and it was something that was percolating a little bit for me when I was at P&G. And it's probably something a lot of leaders and people listening start to think about is like, yeah, there's a lot of knowledge that gets lost in those moments. But my question, and Raman, I don't know if you have any insight into this, is how do you actually capture that institutional knowledge, right? It seems like it's much easier said than done.
Well, I mean, I think you can write a one-pager. You can create a training. That's how you and I met. We created a new hire training way back in the day. But the more powerful thing is experiences and relationships. Ed talks about sitting down with these leaders in conversations and hearing stories and the idea of the campfire. And even that's what this podcast hopes to accomplish. You can't distill it down to 5 bullet points and 5 principles. I mean, you can, and you can go buy that book, but that's harder versus just having a human conversation. What I love about the medium of podcasting is these great leaders are in your ears, and hearing about their experiences and their stories makes the difference. And it sews the point in a lot better.
To that point, you can have a range of ideas, whether a very intentional start, stop, continue type debrief after projects, or like you said, how do you capture them in stories? And in fact, that's something that I know some organizations are doing, P&G included, is a corporate archives or history, or even these fireside chats with these leaders, and actually capture it and make it accessible to other people to pick up on.
Well, because sometimes you aren't going to have heard of the leader or not have known as much about them. And I'll be honest, the next guest that we're going to talk about is Ed Rigaud, and he was one of P&G's first Black senior executives and the founder of the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center. And in a year of really difficult conversations about race in America, this was a really timely one, and I'm glad we had it, even though I didn't know as much about Ed. But hearing his story and his perspective honestly gave me and all of us a lot more to think about.
You saw it. You saw the marchers. By and large, there was a movement there that looked really different from Martin Luther King's civil rights movement.
Different in terms of the colors of the faces?
Makeup, yeah. And the places that it was occurring.
Everywhere.
And how long.
Yeah.
Which says to me that there's a gut reaction that might have been opened up by George Floyd's killing, but maybe it's been sitting there lurking, that precious freedom has gotten challenged. And the majority of folks, at least in the U.S., and it's apparent abroad as well, want to protect that freedom. It's bigger than Black Lives Matter, although that's a handle and it's a brand. And people are willing to risk a lot, even during this pandemic, to show their support for our freedoms, which I find extremely encouraging. But how do you turn that into action?
Right.
And so what I would encourage our leaders is to figure out how to turn it into action. So when we restart the economy, we first rebuild it and restart it in a different way. The gaps that are there, they're not just racial gaps, they're class gaps, and we need to fix that stuff. Having people not having living wages, working 2 or 3 jobs to try to live, come on, that doesn't make any sense. Not with all the wealth that we've got in this country. And so, some of the principles that I learned at P&G and need to be applied, and that's where I think innovation comes in. We know how to manage the front end of innovation with diversity, because diversity really helps there. It's diversity of thought and ideas, as well as backgrounds and ethnicity and race and all that. That's a rich formula for conceptualizing and modeling. But when you get to the last 2 phases, the simple solution, not easy to manage, but simple solution, is to direct that creativity toward execution and discipline. So you are executing much more creatively, but you're not going backwards.
Right. Well, see, the implementation, we've got a lot of work to do. We have to roll up our sleeves and get it done now.
Yeah. 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 And then, it's going to be maybe a little rough.
Isn't that anything worth doing, Ed?
Yeah. 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 It's something that we can teach to everybody. Not everybody's going to want to do the execution phase. If we include everybody appropriately, we're going to be much better off.
All right. So I have to be honest that, before our conversation with Ed, I had only ever heard the name before. Like, obviously you hear the name of this is a great leader, people who really admired him and had learned a lot from him, but I'd only heard the name. And I had been to the Freedom Center in Cincinnati, which I highly recommend people check out. If you are in Cincinnati at any time, go and check it out, because there's a lot of information there, not only about the historic piece of the Underground Railroad, but also modern day slavery. And this, it opens your eyes into what's still going on. But I also didn't know specifically about Ed until this conversation, just how uniquely qualified his perspective and history is, really is, on race in America.
Yeah, you know, I loved how in this conversation we both zoomed in on his experiences as one of the company's first Black executives, and frankly, the non-traditional circumstances, you know, rooted out of Jim Crow that led him to finding his way to P&G, but also because of the very technical nature of the way his mind works. He's an engineer by training, you know, how he started thinking about solutions and frameworks that we need to address some of our country's biggest challenges going forward.
I had a technician who actually served in Hitler's youth army. He didn't trust me at first, and he had a lot of racial views that were ignorant. But we eventually got to be friends, and he told me, he admitted he was frightened to work with me initially. But I would say that the early diversity, well, they call it multiculturalism at the time, the early training was an attempt, but I think it was ill-advised, frankly.
Say more.
Because, well, yeah. What it did, it called on the handful of African-American managers who had been hired during the mid-60s and early 70s to do the training.
Got it. Yeah, I get it. I get what you're saying. It's like, it almost needs to be the leadership of the majority that has to be sharing and endorsing this.
Yeah. And that was further complicated by the tone of race relations during that era.
When was this?
In the late 60s, early 70s.
Okay.
It was very militant.
Wow.
And frankly, the people who were trying to pull this off,
uh-huh,
they were more like me, conciliatory, not militant.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a couple of outside trainers who came in and scared the heck out of the white managers and put them in humiliating positions. I know even John Pepper got one of those. But
did it work, though?
I don't think so. Awareness-wise, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, no question. It worked. It raised awareness, heightened awareness tremendously. And I think we're still behind in this regard. I don't really have a good sense of where P&G is now, but I do know that there are better techniques that haven't been utilized yet. John Pepper and I talk about this all the time. I want the Freedom Center to lead an effort to teach dialogue.
Right.
True dialogue.
Right.
And so my dear friend, Dan Yankelovich, who used to run the largest polling business in the country, also had a consumer insight business.
Mm-hmm.
Dan has a book called The Magic of Dialogue. It lays out very simply what things you need to do, what principles to have true dialogue, true effective dialogue. And that's what we need to be teaching everybody. It just so happens, Dan did the initial research, consumer research, on snacks that led to Pringles.
So he knows a thing or two.
Yeah. One of the learnings, their incredible learning for me, was don't do focus groups to learn anything. Do focus groups to learn the language.
Yeah.
And then do one-on-one in-depths if you really want to get deep insights.
You know, Drew, it's this idea of dialogue and how dialogue matters. We have to get out of echo chambers, only having friends that are just like us or think and believe the same things. And we have to get out of our own bubbles. And the only way to do that is to have conversations with different people, because that's how you create greater empathy and understanding for people that don't look like you.
Yeah. And it's even exacerbated now because of social media. It's so easy to create a bubble and you don't get access to some of the other insight. It starts with dialogue. As an individual, are you seeking out those conversations or dialogues with people who think a little bit differently than you or have experiences that are different from yours? And honestly, that's one of the reasons why I like having you as a friend, Roman, because you're a pretty unusual person.
Feelings pretty mutual, Drew. Feelings pretty mutual.
Well, and honestly, it's one of the things that this podcast provides, is that we're very intentional that we want it to be conversations and conversations with different perspectives. And that is something that I really appreciated with your conversation with Shantanu Khosla, who is P&G's former head of India and managing director for Crompton Greaves. Because as an American, one thing I've always appreciated about it, my time at P&G is seeing our purpose and values filtered through not just a Cincinnati lens or a U.S. lens, but an international global lens. And I love how direct and plain spoken Shantanu's perspective was.
Most things, the problems are because of politics. It doesn't matter where you pick it up. Now, I can understand and I can appreciate that someone in the political profession, whichever country, state, city they may be in, has a certain role on their political agenda. But I think when you come with issues like that, the moral strength and humanity of the individual comes into play. You have to be willing to sacrifice to be able to deal with it objectively and take politics out of the game. And that's an individual thing. And the best leaders take their own personal gains, i.e. politics, out of whatever they do. The best leaders will do what's right by their people and right by the consumer, and not what's right for them to get the next promotion. The next promotion will be because they did right by their people and right by their consumer. And it's the same thing here. And it's such a huge challenge, and it's so complex and difficult that if you're not addressing it as a rational, objective task, but you're letting the things you have to do continuously be influenced by how you are perceived, you're never going to get an optimal solution.
In fast-growing markets like India, you need a real no BS approach to keep up with the pace of change. When Shantanu led India after assignments around the globe, he grew revenue 15x in 13 years, which is just insane. And there's business acumen, but there's also knowing how to motivate an organization and rally them around a vision and kind of get out of their way.
Well, that's a big point that Shantanu mentions as well. The reason he gets to 15x is not just because of hard work, but also that it was driven by his approach to management, and it was to let his people shine. Hearing his approach to accountability and responsibility inspired me to think about the leader that I want to be for my own teams, particularly with what he said about delegating and what to delegate and not delegate.
For me, it's very simple. There's a realization that came to me maybe a decade or so ago, which is that we hire the best people, the smartest people, and then we don't let them do their job. We want to interfere all the time. And if you ask them, their biggest problem is, my boss is always interfering. He's always controlling. He's always telling me what to do. He's not giving me freedom. He's changing his decision. So this sort of disconnect never made sense to me. So if you got the best people, let them do their work. They enjoy it. They become better at it. And the words I put to this now, after all these years, is, you delegate everything except for accountability, because you're still accountable and you've got to figure out how you manage that. But delegate everything except for accountability. We've got the people. And when I left Procter, I began to realize more that every organization doesn't have that strength and depth of capability. So you have to be a little more careful when you do this than what you could do. Procter, 9 times out of 10, the guy knows his job better than you. Yeah. Okay, let him go do it.
All right, so Raman, this is another example where it's like, this is fantastic advice, but from people who have maybe tried to delegate in the past, who have been very good at the execution phase, and then they get into some type of, you know, management or leadership role, it can actually be really hard to give up that control to delegate to someone else, because they're not always going to do it the way that you do it. So any thoughts on how you actually be successful at delegating to someone else and empowering them in a good way?
It's a practice, man. It's not easy. Like, I mean, you know, the production of even this podcast, I'm a pretty super OCD detail-oriented guy, but I'm often reminded of that quote, give a man a fish, feed him for a day, teach a man to fish, feed him for a lifetime. And you got to take the long view. If you're going to hit audacious goals, you can't do it by yourself. You have to do it with a team, and you have to trust and groom them, because that's how you build sustainable systems and teams and companies and organizations. You've got to get great people, but then you got to get out of their way, and they're going to make mistakes, but you've got to help them. You got to pick them back up. You've got to show them your mistakes. You've got to be brutally honest and have radical candor to kind of solve the problem together, but let them solve the problem. People have to learn. And again, it's a long-term values-driven thinking.
Yeah, my take on that quote is, if you tell a man a joke, then he'll laugh once. If you teach a man to joke, they'll laugh for an entire lifetime, right? Just replace fish with puns and it basically still works. But I think it's a great point is part of it starts with, as we've heard previously, the value of hiring the right people and then really getting out of the way for them and having a clear vision of what you're shooting for. So that, okay, maybe they're not going to get there the exact same way that you would, but as long as you're still headed in that same direction, you know, you can have a great impact.
And so our last conversation is with Bob McDonald, who was P&G's former CEO and the 8th U.S. Secretary of Veterans Affairs. And my conversations with Bob were another favorite of the show. You know, beyond his experiences in the military and as CEO, he served in the president's cabinet. And, you know, over the last year that we've been living through with the coronavirus pandemic, I had to ask about his observations on leadership in government during the last time we faced a similar crisis in the Ebola epidemics.
It's more than politics. At the time, we were going through cabinet meetings, sometimes daily, sometimes weekly on Ebola. And President Obama was getting advice at the time, the leading Republican candidate for president, who was saying, close the borders, don't let people in. And all the medical professionals around the table said, don't do that because the people go underground, we won't find them. And when we talked about what to do, it was clear that we had the relationships internationally. Marty Dempsey was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He was a year ahead of me at West Point. And we sent the Army Medical Corps to West Africa, and we literally tried to end the Ebola virus in West Africa so it couldn't come here. And it reminded me of the principle I learned in the Army, but it's also a principle I learned in business or at the VA, which is you run to the gunfire. Mm-hmm. You know, shutting borders is one thing. I mean, that works to some degree, but you're better off running to the gunfire and trying to expunge the bad virus at its source. So I often wonder if we had better relationship with China, or if China was in better relationship with us, because I'm not trying to say it's our U.S. fault or China sure. fault, but sure. why not send all the world's medical experts to Wuhan and stop that virus there rather than allowing it to go around the world?
It's really about playing the long game, right? The harder right sometimes.
Yeah, and well, as the former chairman of the U.S.-China Business Council, that's something certainly I would have suggested, is let's go to Wuhan, let's try to stop it there.
This is what I love about this podcast, is our ability to talk to people who are doing fascinating, interesting things and the insights that they gain from, because it's like, I'm never going to be in a position where I'm helping to fight the Ebola virus in West Africa, most likely. But the insights drawn from that, which is what I think is essentially the definition of bravery that we talked about, is like to not shy away from the tough problems, but as a leader, to be the one to go at them head on.
Yeah, it's about character. It's about choosing the harder right over the easier wrong, which is a quote that we actually heard from a handful of guests on this podcast. And beyond being in the president's cabinet, Bob McDonald's on the incoming president's transition team. And we actually had a second conversation with Bob just before the election. He was gracious enough to share his perspective on service and character right before we took part in arguably the most important election of our lives.
I think leadership in politics, and again, your listeners may disagree with me, but I'm not a politician. I've never run for office. What I've done is I've put myself in situations to serve, but always nominated or appointed. Leadership is about doing the right thing and having that transcend politics. What becomes challenging and what the American people don't like and distrust is when politicians appear to be putting their reelection prospects above the greater good or above the purpose or values of the country.
I'm reminded of, and I've heard it on this podcast from a few veterans now, the West Point prayer.
Yeah, the West Point cadet prayer, right. And it's a prayer that we said every day in chapel at West Point. But there's that collection of words that go, help me to choose the harder right rather than the easier wrong. And never to be content with partial truth when the whole can be gained.
That's powerful.
Well, the difficult things in life are the ones that are worth doing, and the difficult things are usually the right thing. And my advice to leaders
years ago when I was still working was, if something appears too easy to do, get skeptical that it may be the wrong thing.
That message to me felt, you know, more appropriate this year than perhaps ever before, that purpose, values, and character itself doesn't just apply to where we work, but also in the actions and choices that we collectively make as a society and the choices that we make every day as individuals.
What I really have come to love about this podcast is the opportunity we get to talk to some leaders who have had some amazing experiences, and we can all learn from them, not just how to be better business leaders, but better human beings.
And this episode just scratches the surface of that. And in the coming weeks, we'll be sharing some of the learnings from other great leaders that we've had on the show in our first year. And as always, if you want to hear more from these guests, the full interviews with each one that we've had, you can find that information on our podcast feed or at pgalums.com/podcast. But we'll be back next week with some of our highlights from our conversations with big brand leaders from companies like Levi's, Logitech, Nike, and Google. So be sure to check it out.
And that's our show. Like what you heard? Please subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcasting platform. For show notes about this episode, links to things mentioned, or requests for sponsorship, visit pgalums.com/podcast. Follow us on Twitter at pgalumpod. We'd love to hear from you.
Learnings from Leaders is a production of the P&G Alumni Network, a global nonprofit founded by former P&Gers committed to community, enrichment, and philanthropy. With more than 45,000 registered members worldwide, the network connects alums through global conferences, local chapters, industry events, and online content. Our nonprofit foundation supports economic empowerment communities around the world. To find out more, visit pgalums.com.
That's it for this week. I've been Roman Segal.
And I'm still Andrew Tarvin. Thanks for joining Learnings from Leaders, the P&G Alumni Podcast. We'll see you next time.